We are in the waning days of summer today in the Granite State. Welcome to the Party Line Podcast. My name is Colin Booth, Communications Director at the NHTP, and I'm here again with your host, New Hampshire Democratic Party Chair Ray Buckley.
Hey, hey, Granite Staters. Welcome to another episode of the Party Line Podcast, hosted by yours truly, me. This week is really interesting. We have State Representative Catherine Rombo of Bedford. She's going to be one of the co-chairs of our upcoming 2023 state convention. She's an attorney and is on the forefront of turning Bedford from ruby red to bright blue. It is an amazing process for somebody to witness. But, Colin, back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Chairman. First, updates from the NHTP. Can you tell us, Chairman, a little about what's happening at the party?
Sure. We've got the very special, very important upcoming special election in Enfield with Democratic candidate David Fracht on August 22nd. That's tomorrow. And of course, the very important Hal Rafter election in Northwood, Nottingham on September 19th. To help us out, reach out to Julian Sutcliffe at julian@nhhousedems.org to get involved. Also coming up, we've got the New Hampshire Democratic State Party Convention coming up on Saturday, September 30th in Bedford at Bedford High School. We've got very special guests and a whole long list of exciting things that are going to be happening. So be sure to save the date. And the New Hampshire Young Dems have their 11th annual summer barbecue on August 23rd at 6 p.m. at Cisco Brewers in Portsmouth. You know, the New Hampshire Young Dems are the premier organization of electing young Democrats here in New Hampshire, and they make every other state organization around the country look pitiful. So make sure that you give them your support at the email at info@nhyd.org for tickets.
As usual, so many great things going on. These special elections, cannot stress enough how important they are, especially this Northwood one. Wow. Hal Rafter, incredible candidate, going up against Jim Gazofsky, a terrible candidate. Moving on, political news in the Granite State and beyond. The major news this week, Donald Trump under indictment once again, this time Fulton County, Georgia. Many of his associates involved in a sprawling racketeering conspiracy related to their efforts to overturn the 2020 election results in that state. 13 felony counts in all. This is his fourth indictment this year, along with the federal documents case in Florida, the hush money case in New York, and the federal election case in Washington, D.C. Whew. All right, Chairman, I wanted to dive into this with you. You know, on the one hand, Trump is leading the Republican field here in New Hampshire and the rest of the country by a wide margin, something like 30, 40 points. But on the other hand, these cases are just so incredibly serious. They have to catch up to him eventually. You know, all that to say, how do you see this playing out?
Those who are true MAGA believers are not just something that Donald Trump created. These individuals have been spoon-fed to believe lies and to not believe truth for decades now. I mean, this started in the 70s through the 80s and right up through that there was a plan, a plot, a strategy by some people on the far right to knowing that they can't win legitimately. And they can't even win, you know, by thinking that they can somehow explain their positions. What they had to do is they had to demonize the other side. And then when you demonize the other side, you then lionize your side. And so Trump just simply utilized what was available. It is heartbreaking to see the people interviewed on television, in response that are MAGA believers. Yeah. They absolutely, with all their heart, believe that he's a victim.
Yeah.
And it's, there is not a thing on earth that is going to change their mind.
Yeah.
Luckily, they're not anywhere near the majority of the country. I feel bad for the Republican Party in the sense that, you know, the country needs a strong two-party system. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump grabbed the throat of the Republican Party in late 2015 and is just taking it and batting it against the wall. And by the time the establishment woke up and realized it, it's too late. And every time that another indictment occurs, I think it's a sad day for America. It is absolutely, how do historians look back on this time and think of it as anything other than an absolute disgrace? It is very difficult to process how gullible so many people are in America to believe somebody as completely crooked, but convinced that the other side was crooked. It is everything that Trump accused Hillary Clinton of in 2016, he has proven multi times over that was him.
Yeah.
He was describing himself when he was describing Hillary.
Right.
It's just sick.
It's sick. I mean, you look at his long, sprawling history of criminality, his unbelievable record of lawsuits, you know, relating to his real estate dealings. I mean, unwillingness to pay contractors. I mean, the list goes on, to say nothing of the sexual assaults that go back, you know, decades. It's unbelievable. And the Republican, you know, pivot to actually it's a Biden crime family. What is the term they're using? It's a Biden crime syndicate, I think they're calling it now.
It's crazy.
Like, I get that plays with the primary crowd, but like, you know, what are people supposed to believe?
I'm sorry. Did anyone in the Biden family get a $2 billion contract from Saudi Arabia?
Right.
$2 billion?
Yeah.
Not 2,000.
Right.
Not 200,000. Not 2 million.
Yeah.
Not 200 million.
Right.
$2 billion.
I mean, it's this, the level of corruption with the Trump family is so staggering.
Shameless.
And the idea that we're supposed to believe that somehow Joe Biden is some kind of a criminal mastermind is, I mean, it's just the most pathetic.
I think people forget that when Beau was dying, that the cost of his, because he would resign as Attorney General, losing his health care.
Right.
And so Joe and Jill were going to either sell their home or mortgage their home to be able to pay for Beau's final month's health care.
Yeah.
And it was a personal loan from Barack and Michelle Obama that allowed them to keep their home.
Right.
A family that is a crime syndicate isn't involved in this or stuff. It's just bullshit.
It's such bullshit. Ugly bullshit, not surprising. Speaking on the topic of ugly bullshit, this week we also saw we saw State Senator Keith Murphy plead not guilty to 2 counts of simple assault and 1 count of criminal threatening, the charges stemming from an April 30th confrontation with an employee at his restaurant in Manchester, where he supposedly hocked a loogie on one of them and threatened him with
the important part,
yes,
is that not one person has come forward saying, that's not the Keith Murphy I know.
No, we got some members of the Senate who said, I vigorously defend him. Didn't say it's not in his character. It's that,
as compared to when a Democrat was accused of violence against somebody else, we immediately call for that person's resignation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, and it's sick.
Well, and, you know, Keith was in a precarious position. He had just moved to Manchester. Now, he had lived on the west side of Manchester for when he first arrived here as part of the early homesteaders of the
Free State
movement. Kept running for state rep, kept losing, got pissed off about that, and then moved to Bedford. Mm-hmm. Got elected there for a couple times, got divorced from his first wife, and then married his second wife and moved to the north end of Manchester, just happened to be in District 16, remarkably got appointed as the nominee in a very bizarre twist of things that happened that year. So he does not have deep roots in District 16. 16, right. Obviously, they did everything they can to try to gerrymander Kevin Kavanaugh out of his Senate seat. But and while he did lose two Manchester wards and gained Goffstown, that seat is not beyond winnable, and especially in the presidential year when the turnout is going to be historically high.
Yeah, especially when you're coming into an election with a record like this. And, speaking of Kevin Kavanaugh, I saw a great meme online today. It said, worst trade-off ever, and it was a picture of Kevin Kavanaugh, and then it was a picture of Keith Murphy's mugshot from his arrest.
True dat, as they say.
Finally, Chairman, as we said at the top, the town of Enfield has a special election on Tuesday. Wanted to know if we could get your predictions on how that's going to go.
I predict that the Democratic candidate will win by a squeaker.
A squeaker, okay.
It will keep us up all night long before we know who is victorious.
You think so?
And maybe even a recount.
Wow, okay. I feel like you're being a little facetious here, actually.
Maybe.
Maybe. I think this is a Biden plus 30 district. I don't know.
Yeah. it's hard for me. I've never lived in a Democratic district. I've always lived in either a Republican district or a very purpley red district.
Sure.
So to even imagine being in a district with that sort of Democratic performance is just too difficult for me to process. So I have to imagine it's going to be a tight race.
Fair enough. Whatever helps you sleep at night. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of tight races and, you know, someone that won in a special election, that's Representative Catherine Rombo, who we're going to hear from right now. Well, today we've got the honor of interviewing Representative Catherine Rombo, representing Bedford in the New Hampshire House of Representatives. Representative Rombo won an upset special election in September of 2021, overturning generations of Republican leadership in Bedford and what was once considered the most Republican stronghold. Then she won re-election in 2022. Catherine's been an attorney for 18 years, practicing labor and employment law with degrees from New York University School of Law and Amherst College. And she has a husband and two daughters in Bedford. Representative Rondo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Chairman Buckley.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about your journey into New Hampshire politics? What prompted you to want to be involved? A lot of people aren't involved, and you decided, hey, I'm going to do this.
Sure. I think always through my life, I've been a joiner. I've believed in getting involved in community and volunteering. But we had moved to New Hampshire with our family and moved to Bedford to raise our family in the community and schools there. And I was starting to get involved with volunteering and schools and activities with the kids. But I'll be honest, it sounds a little bit cliche, but the 2016 election was a real wake-up call. And a reminder to me, I'm turning 40. I'm apparently a grown up now. And I have experience, I think, that can be helpful. And I can't sit around and complain if I'm unhappy about where I see things going, certainly in my community. And I thought, you know, I want to look for opportunities to serve, to use the experience I have in a way that I think might be helpful. And it was as simple as there was a advertisement in the back of the Bedford Bulletin that the town council was holding elections a few months later. And I thought, you know, that could be a good place to start. Maybe my experience as an attorney will be helpful. And I like the idea of serving on a theoretically collaborative board.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, it was a good first experience in terms of it being a shorter campaign cycle just in my local community. We were somewhat new to Bedford at that point. So it really was a great chance for me to get out and meet so many new people in Bedford and connect with more people. My whole family was very helpful and supportive. My kids were stuffing envelopes and coming with me to the transfer station. And I remember coming home after doing my first local Community Access Television Roundtable and thinking, oh my goodness, you know, I'm not sure if I can do this. I'm not sure if I got the right answer. And then I watched it and I thought, you know what? I can do this. A lot of people in our community can do this. It's just a matter of making the time, making the commitment, and learning and listening, getting better.
What was the most amazing thing that you learned early on the town council? There's something that happens. You're like, I had no idea.
One thing that continues to amaze me is how strongly people in Bedford felt about sidewalks. Very local issue. Did not realize that it would be such a flashpoint in terms of what people perceive as development or how they think it affects their community.
I honestly don't think I've ever noticed a single sidewalk in Bedford.
There are not many sidewalks in Bedford. Yes. So that was there were a lot of learning points. Early on, there were a lot of conflicts over cell towers and housing developments, and there was sort of big issues, but playing out in very particular ways to the community. So it was a steep learning curve, certainly.
Well, Sue Mullen won for the first time, and she was reelected, and people were like, well, that's just her. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's just such an extraordinary leader in the community that. That her election really doesn't have anything to do with her being a Democrat. Really just she's built a lifetime of relationships. And then he won that special election. So there were two Democrats from Bedford, which, frankly, I never thought I'd live to see the day. for one, never mind two. And then you were reelected. And an additional member, Sue didn't run for an additional term, but another member, another Democrat, did get elected. So there are two elected state representatives. What do you think, how did you campaign differently in the special election versus the general election in 22?
Well, I can't say enough how much I think Sue Mullen's impact mattered for me personally, for the community. Sue is sui generis. I mean, she really is a unique individual in Bedford and built on decades of relationships. But she also, I think, showed many of us in Bedford that there are folks out there who want to consider candidates from different parties, people that they think speak to their values. And she was there to support me. I'm so grateful for her help along the way in terms of learning how to campaign and connect with more folks in town and hopefully passing that along now with Representative Lauren Fox. I like to have carpool buddies. I'm glad that we've managed to build a trend for the last couple of years to the State House. But in terms of the special versus the general, the special election obviously is a unique opportunity because we had a one-on-one contest. And so it's in a district where you have seven state reps. A special election was an opportunity to break out and to get a little more focus on who I was as a candidate or my opponent. Sometimes it's hard to cut through that noise when you have such a large slate in that large district. So I was able to really focus on my mailings and focus on my message just for me and not just as a slate of candidates. So it was certainly a unique opportunity. And then in the general, I think we really like to focus on building a good team of Democratic candidates for the district and obviously building off of what I had done in the special.
Well, there are many things that have attributed to the downfall of much of what we just a generation ago looked upon with politics. And one of which is gerrymandering in Washington. The part of why there's such stalemates is that the congressional seats are so gerrymandered that you get the extremes on each side. And there are very few purple districts in between. Out of the 435 seats, I think there are like 18 that are competitive. And it's similar to that in the New Hampshire House, where there are so many that are really hard red or Republican or hard blue for Democratic. And you're one of those that are in the purple districts. Do you feel a sense of responsibility for that, of bringing people together and really solving problems?
I certainly feel a sense of responsibility, yes, to set that tone of trying to bring people together, trying to solve problems. I think that's what we're elected to do, right? To solve problems, to be practical, not to create problems, not to create partisan divide. You know, I think when I first started running, as you may recall, I ran three times before I was elected. So it took some time, and it took my learning how to be a better candidate also. But I think in some ways my naivete perhaps served me well early on, because I did not have maybe as deep-rooted a sense or belief that Bedford was so deeply red. I felt like the connections and relationships I had built in Bedford so far were much more purple. And so I think if I just knock enough doors and I talk to enough people and I talk about what they're worried about in terms of housing or roads or schools, then hopefully they can trust that I will make thoughtful decisions if I can get to the state house. So I do feel a sense of responsibility for that being the tone I set while I'm in office. Yes.
You know, during my 18 years in the House, we didn't have population of free staters. I remember when they announced that they were going to come in and invade New Hampshire and try to take over. And now there's a couple dozen of them in the House. And many of them have extraordinarily extreme, nutty, I guess is a nice way of saying it, ideas for what they want society to be. How do you find working with them, and have you been able to overcome their real oddity of believing that we should live in some sort of dystopian gun-raising situation? How are you able to work with them, if you have been able to?
Yeah, you know, I think not just with free stater legislators, but just generally with some of the divisions across the aisle, it's been interesting. I serve on the House Transportation Committee, which I think is, as a committee, can be a little less ideologically fraught maybe than some others in terms of the types of legislation that we see. And I find in committee, you know, folks are really pretty respectful of each other, pretty civil, trying to find solutions together. A bill that feels too extreme to one side, we can work on it, we can whittle it down, we can build it up. And that falls apart on certain bills that can be divisive, I realize. But for the most part, I see a lot of practical efforts and some you know, cross aisle efforts. And then sometimes you get onto the House floor and you've got 400 people and it just, all that goes out the window and it becomes extremely divided. And it seems very hard to have conversations because you're not having conversations with each other. You know, you have somebody at the well and everybody's in their seat. And so then it becomes, it feels much more intractable sometimes to get some work done. So I see the most work getting done in committee. In terms of your question about free state influence or how to work with folks, I just think it's really important that we're talking to our constituents about what some of those philosophical positions look like playing out in legislation, particularly in terms of how it affects our public schools. Bedford, as you know, is a community that really takes a lot of pride in its public schools, and there are a lot of families that moved there, have stayed there. And I think it's important for them to hear about what's happening with funding and what's happening with undermining schools at a pretty intense level.
So I remember as a fourth grader, as New Hampshire people are always brought to the state house, and the first time I saw the floor of the house. And I, you know, I worked for the House for a few years, and then I got elected on my own. It was still a completely different experience walking on as a member. Talk a little bit about that experience the first time you went onto that floor of 400 seats.
Oh, man, it's incredibly meaningful. It feels like a tremendous honor and responsibility. The first time I came onto the floor in session, we were still largely masked, many legislators, and there was still a fair amount of stress about where we're sitting, COVID exposure. And so that felt complicated too. You know, the House had not met in Representatives Hall for a long stretch at that point, and I was new to the House. So there were a lot of layers at that time. But I mean, it's such an impressive space, and to know that you're part of such a long history of a citizens' legislature is really, really powerful.
What was your first big speech?
I have given a couple of speeches. I finally gave one on a bill that passed this year. I mean, this past June, for requiring child car seats rear-facing for mm-hmm. children to age two. It was Senator Donovan Fenton's bill, who had been on House Transportation when he was a state rep. And so I was really pleased to be able to speak on that bill, because to me that sort of legislation is what the meat and potatoes of what we should be doing, practical bills that keep kids safe. And I was happy to see that we were able to get enough support, and I believe the governor signed it yesterday. So,
Whenever I read about that bill, I certainly reminded of what it was like growing up in the 60s, where there really weren't car seats mm-hmm. and there were not seat belts. Mm-hmm. But whenever I think I heard a comedian telling this joke that, you know, as an adult, if you're riding in the car with your mother and, you know, all of a sudden it comes to a stop, her arm just reflexly comes out and knocks the wind out of you. And absolutely happened to me multiple times, so much so that I said, I'm not riding with you anymore.
I still have that reflex, fling my arm out. Yeah,
it's not something she consciously did. Yep. It just was this automatic, because she was the seatbelt. Yeah. She was the car seat.
Yeah.
And to see how we've advanced is just remarkable. Mm-hmm. And the amount of lives that will be saved is phenomenal. So thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously challenges, sacrifices serving in the House. If you were recruiting another mom with kids at home, what would you tell them why it's worth it, and how to manage balance?
Sure. I think that bill we were just talking about is a really good example of a way that, you know, legislation can hit close to home for many of us, when you're talking about raising your family and keeping your family and your kids safe. I think that there are a lot of people who, if they can have the opportunity to connect those dots and think, these are values that I hold dear, these are things that are important to me, whether it's, you know, very niche, like a very specific, like car seat, or if you're talking about, you know, reproductive rights and bodily autonomy, that these lofty, big issues. Being a state rep in New Hampshire is amazing that you can be so involved in crafting legislation and voting your values. And so I think it's just important for us to keep talking to others in our community about what that looks like and what being a state rep means. And in terms of the commitment, I know people get a little overwhelmed. I've been grateful and appreciative. I have a flexible job in terms of my schedule. So while I work a lot, I have some control over when I can do that. I understand and appreciate not everybody has that. But if you do have some control over your schedule, the House meets when it meets to vote and you need to be there, but you can also work on committees that some committees are not as big of a time commitment, and you can be conscious and mindful about those choices. But I would also add that I am always trying to encourage people to consider running for local offices or volunteering on local boards, land use boards, running for school board, all those positions that don't require you to be up in Concord necessarily, but have huge impact in communities, and also maybe get you ready to try something in a few more years at running for the state house. I mean, it took me some time too.
Well, we're looking at the election of 2024, many folks consider the chances of electing a Democratic governor as pretty high. The record of the non-Sununu elections, if you take out those four that he was elected, Democrats won 9 out of the 10 previous gubernatorial elections, and feel pretty upbeat and positive about the Democrats' chances. So that gives you the opportunity of having a Democratic governor. And I know when Senator Shaheen was first elected governor, there were, you know, a couple of issues. I was like, I never thought I'd be able to get in that because I knew a Republican governor would never sign. It was repeal of the ban on adoption foster care for gays and lesbians. And it went through and it was just a big moment. Is there an issue that you're looking, saying, well, you know, I know as long as Sununu was in office, I wasn't going to be able to pass that for that would really have a big impact. But with the idea that we're going to have a new governor, more than likely a majority in the House and in the Senate, what's like that one issue that's been kind of gnawing at the back of your head there, like given the opportunity that you can introduce and really see that it's going to have an impact on something that's not really a front burner issue, it's just something that you knew was important?
That's a good question. I feel like there are a number of areas, right, where we would hope to make inroads of better legislation if we have a change in the governor's office. I feel like the first thing that comes to mind is really hoping that we can make changes in terms of these school voucher programs that have been bills that have been flying through in the last couple of years. I'd like to see legislation that is protecting of our school funding and also cognizant of the impact on our local property taxes. And that's something I talk about a lot in Bedford too. It's not only the chipping away at the foundation of our public school system, it's also increasing costs to residents in a way that does not feel transparent to me, necessarily for voters. So I feel like that is an area that I think it's really important that we get on if we have a Democratic governor who will be on board with signing those bills.
I think a lot of people, especially in New Hampshire, are a little confused by the whole concept of vouchers and how the money, where the money comes from and how it was budgeted and, you know, was the budget right or wrong. Can you just imagine you're talking to somebody just walking down the street? They go, what is the voucher system? Do you have any kind of way of quickly explaining how that all works?
Yeah, I try to hit on a couple points. First, I just try to explain the general concept that if you have a child that you want to not have in the public school system, that you're eligible currently for a voucher that would allow you to put a certain amount of money, several thousand dollars, towards private school or religious school, homeschool. That there's not a limit on that. I think some people at least are kind of astounded to learn that we can be using tax dollars to put towards
and
religious school.
Are these alternatives well regulated or governed?
Are we no, and that's sure the thing that there are very, very few guardrails on the programs for the funding.
So we don't
but
even
also
know
what the schools require for correct.
Right. If the children are actually being actually educated.
When I try to remind people too that public schools have an obligation to meet children in terms of their needs, if there are special needs. Bedford's really proud of having a really robust program, and that a lot of families have moved to because their kids can get better services in Bedford. And the schools, the non-public schools who are receiving voucher funds do not need to meet any of those anti-discrimination provisions, special service, educational services provisions. Those are not required either. So there's that impact. And then I just try to talk through with residents the idea that if you are pulling $4,000 or $5,000 out to give to family to send to private school, that money is coming out of your public school system, and it's not a one-for-one transfer. So, you know, it's not like you can just have one fewer teacher or, you know, close a classroom. You still have to fund the functioning of the buildings. You still need to fund the salaries of the teachers. And so that gap is being made up by local property taxes.
Great. Well, you know, on Saturday, September 30th, hundreds of New Hampshire Democrats and national members of the media will be converging on Bedford High School. And you're going to serve as the co-chair along with Representative Ben Ming of Hollis. What have the Bedford Dems talked about? What kind of message they want people leaving Bedford with?
I will say, we hope that folks will leave Bedford High School after the convention thinking, oh, this is a community that is really committed to change, that is really committed to the purple nature of our community, as we were talking about earlier, and that there's a ton of energy. I mean, the the Bedford Democrats, along with DBCC and other, you know, organizations, have put so much effort in the last couple of years of building a real grassroots team for supporting candidates, but also supporting Democratic values and getting that messaging out in the community. So for the convention to be at the high school in a community that has, you know, historically been regarded as much more Republican is really exciting. I know in 2016 it was a great experience. I'm thrilled to be part of it in terms of getting to introduce such amazing speakers and leaders this year.
Terrific. Well, one last question.
Mm-hmm.
You chose to live in Bedford. You looked at the whole state of New Hampshire. It's like, I'm going to move to Bedford. Well, Bedford is next to the city of Manchester. Mm-hmm. What is your most favorite thing about Manchester?
Well, I have a couple. I actually just came from Manchester this morning, dropping my daughter off at the Palace Theater for camp. But, you know, part of choosing Bedford also meant choosing Manchester because we liked the idea of being near more cultural opportunities, more restaurants, more chances for the kids to be involved in activities. So my first thought is the Bookery, but that's a very specific answer. But I just think Manchester has worked really hard to build an inviting downtown that for not just for folks in Manchester, but for the communities around them, which we appreciate.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us, Representative Catherine Rumbo of Bedford, and we'll see you on September 30th.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Chairman Buckley.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Party Line Podcast, brought to you by the New Hampshire Democratic Party.